Tradition, the Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought, published by the Rabbinical Council of America, is proud to present A Jewish Philosophy of Man, a lecture series by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. The Rav delivered this series of 12 lectures in 1958 and 1959 before an audience of Jewish social service professionals as part of a program of the Jewish Education Committee of New York. Using audio files provided by the Toras HaRav Foundation, these recordings have been curated and remastered by Mark Smilowitz in order to provide the best listening and learning experience. For more information, including full transcriptions and supplementary materials for this series, please visit the Tradition website at traditiononline.org/JPM. Lecture 2, Methodology for a Jewish Religious Anthropology from Metaphysical to Practical, originally delivered on November 20th, 1958.
I'll have now to continue. I see the analysis of methodology of a Jewish philosophy of religion in general and of men in particular. Because whenever we speak about Judaism, it's very important. It's unfortunate that many people don't forget this approach. It is essential that Jewish philosophy of religion be placed in the general perspective of Occidental thought, not to speak about Jewish philosophy of religion from a parochial viewpoint. Then it becomes a sermon, not a philosophy. Yes, this is the trouble with many rabbis when they speak about Jewish concepts. They rely on Jewish sources, usually on secondary sources, and without making an effort to place the Jewish viewpoint within a general frame of reference, Occidental thought in general and Occidental religion in particular. And if we want to interpret Judaism in modern terms, which should make sense not only to the Jew but to the Gentile as well, then we must change our approach and try to see Judaism under the aspect of general cultural creativity. Of course, Judaism has its unique features, its singular world outlook, but however, even in order to emphasize the uniqueness of Jewish thought, we must compare it with concepts of the universal cognitive approach of man. Now that's what I'll continue. In spelling out our religious anthropology, that's exactly the topic of this series of lectures. Philosophy of man, when I speak, I'm not meaning scientific anthropology. In conceptual terms, our philosophy of man, we have to reckon with two basic problems, which complicate our task. One problem is universal in scope and in character, and will always be encountered by anybody, not only by a Jew, but by any homo religiosus, when he is ready to interpret a subjective religious experience in objective philosophical terms or forms. The first problem is not a specifically Judaic, so to say, dilemma. This dilemma will be faced by everyone, by any homo religiosus, Christian or Muslim alike, when he wants to interpret the religious subjective experience in objective terms. Over the centuries, and I want to explain what the problem is, over the centuries, and perhaps the millennia, the logos, this is the comprehensive cognitive gesture on the part of man, I'll just use the Greek term, the logos, has developed a peculiar methodology of objectification and interpretation of our mundane subjective experience, of our sense experience. And this methodology proved to be of enormous advantage to us. I mean the scientific technological approach. Over the millennia, and of course since the rise of modern physics, modern science, with the advent of the Galileo-Newtonian physics, the Logos has developed a main apparatus, a methodological apparatus, how to approach nature, how to interpret our sense experiences. Science studying reality under the pragmatic aspect, because it's the only aspect under which science studies reality, pragmatic utilitarian aspect, and asking only one question, how? Is not interested in the why, seldom interested in the what, always interested in the how it functions, how it works, has gradually created cognitive tools and instruments such as conceptual means of classification, categorical forms of thought, and unique means of formulation that opened up to us or to man actually many hidden nooks and corners in reality. Since this approach has resulted in man's gradual conquest of his environment, so we are, of course, inclined to absolutize, canonize, and apostatize the scientific approach. When I say scientific approach, I mean the so-called the technological scientific approach, as the only gesture of which the Logos is capable and to which the world or the non-self orders will respond. Forgetting, it's a very important thesis, forgetting that reality is not a monolithic affair. It is a many-faceted affair and lends itself to a variety of interpretations. If we say that the only approach to reality is the positivistic, scientific one, then it would be useless to speak about philosophy of religion. If we want to speak about theology, dealing with objects in which science has absolutely no interest, with which science is not concerned at all, like God, like spiritual existence, like a transcendental reality, then, religion is welcome to it. But as I said last time, Judaism is not interested in theology. Judaism basically is interested in ontology. It means in interpretation of our concrete existential experience. So Judaism actually will have to deal with the same objects with which science deals. And not only Judaism, any civilized religion. So the question is, for instance, with concepts of time, with concepts of causality, concepts of substance, or with person, deep person, man, the mind, the soul, his emotional life, his strivings and feelings and experiences. The question, should Judaism avail itself of the same instruments which were developed by science? Then all Judaism could do is just to be a pseudo-psychology. A Judaic philosophy of man would be either a pseudo-psychology or a pseudo-psychiatry or a pseudo-anthropology. The best it would be poor apologetics. If this is the case, so you could actually, dispense with this series of lectures. And I, with my career as a teacher of philosophy of religion, there would be no need. So actually, if we speak about philosophy of religion, so apparently you think that in spite of the tremendous attainments on the part of science, still there is a possibility to interpret reality under many aspects. There is, cognition is not a monolithic, so to say, approach. There are a variety of aspects under which you may look at reality. And there are many forms of thought and many categorical apparata which you may employ in your approach to it. Even within the scientific realm, what strengthens our faith in that? In a plurality of cognitive approach. What strengthens is the fact that even within the scientific realm, the methodical logical approach varies and differs in accordance with the particular concern of the researcher. Even within the scientific realm, there is not a monolithic approach. We'll take, for instance, the category of time, in which Judaism is particularly interested. For is differently used and applied by the physicist, biologist, historian, and psychologist. While, for instance, the physicist employs time only as a frame of quantitative reference, I would say as a classifying principle within a coordinate system. To speak in physics about past, present, and future is as nonsensical as to speak about meaningfulness in physics or a system of values for the physicist. There is no past, there is no future, and there is no present. Time is actually quantified, spatialized. It's time on the clock, spatialized. And we know very well, I mean, whoever has an elementary knowledge of physics, that all physical phenomena occurring in time are reversible and retraceable, theoretically. Practically, you can't reverse them because of the second law of thermodynamics. Because energy is being disorganized in the form of heat. But otherwise, but this is only an engineering law. It has nothing to do with theoretical physics. It was discovered by Carnot. But theoretically, I could see, I mean, for instance, a motion which occurs in time, from here to there, I could reverse the motion. There is no past. There is no bygones in physics. Every process in physics is theoretically, mathematically reversible, retraceable. So this is one approach to the category of time. You see, while for the physicist, time is only a principle within a coordinate system, the biologist, and Bergson already noticed that, sees in time the basis of growth and development as the forming principle determining the unfolding of the life drama. It's something more essential to the biologist than to the physicist. I mean, we don't have to identify ourselves with Bergson, with the idea of creative time. But it is the category is differently understood. And the historian or the psychologist, of course, they would equate time, particularly the psychologist, with our existential awareness, with the so-called Cartesian consensia, with the stream of consciousness, to use a James expression, or the stream of feelings. So you ask the question, either or, what is time? Already for history, there is past and present and future. It's not just a line like Kant described time, a straight line. There is past and present and future. There's already the confluence of all three dimensions. I mean, to the historian and even to the psychologist, time is not a one-dimensional line, nor a two-dimensional, so to say, surface, but it's a three-dimensional experience. So you'll ask either or, is there a conflict between the physicist and the biologist and the psychologist and the historian? Certainly no conflict. It indicates only that reality lends itself to a variety of interpretations. The same is true of causality, and the same is true of substance, and the same is true of many other basic concepts which actually constitute, I mean, the categorical apparatus which we employ in our cognitive venture to interpret a very strange and peculiar reality which surrounds us. These basic categories, apparently, are not fixed or rigid forms of thought in which man clothes his intellectual response to the challenge of a world within and a world outside of him. At all levels, they are rather flexible media subject to change and modification, adjustable to meet the specific demands of an inquiring mind and its peculiar interests. Our categorical system is molded by noetic motives. It depends what is the motive of my inquiry that prompts us to investigate a sector of reality under a certain aspect. If the motivating factor is the pragmatic one, and the question is how, then the technological category is employed. I mean, this is the physical or the chemical, I mean, the so-called mathematical sciences. However, when the inquisitiveness is aroused not by the how question, but the metaphysical question of why, then the method of approach changes. It shifted from the how to the why or to the what. In case of awakening of the curiosity of the homo religiosus, we focus our attention not on the how, nor on the what, it's not so important, but upon the problem of the arche and telos, upon origin, metaphysical origin, and metaphysical destiny, upon their where from and whither, and the question of the homo religiosus, which he addresses to reality, is the old Latin problem question, the old Latin phrase, quo vadis, where do you march? In each instance, the logos adapts itself, the logos in answering the question adapts itself to the particular mood. I'm not speaking now about psychological moods, not emotional moods, to the particular, it's a cognitive, noetic mood. To the particular noetic mood of the inquiring mind, and hence over to us the media which are flexible to the purpose of the inquiry and meet the demands of the particular world perspective into which the results of the investigation will be integrated. This we must bear in mind, otherwise I cannot speak about religious interpretation of reality. Of course, some students of religion, and particularly of religion in modern form, have been misled by their interest in an admiration for the general categories of thought, I mean the strictly mathematical scientific categories of thought, which have been molded by the positivistic approach to reality. They're being misled by their admiration for these categories into a distorted account of religion as a world philosophy. They attempted to interpret religious experiences in terms of positivistic, scientific, or secular thinking, thus failing to see the peculiar structural patterns of the religious experience and its unique aspects, angles, and outlook, and became entangled either in sterile apologetics or in platitudinous sentimentalism. I believe you asked me last time, what's my attitude toward reconstruction, you know? Although I have made up my mind not to criticize others, but to try to praise my own merchandise. However, one of the basic, say, deficiencies in the reconstructionist method is exactly what I say the application of positivistic scientific categories, concepts, and basic forms of thought to the religion, to this paradoxical approach of man to God. Somehow this experience does not lend itself to such an interpretation. And if you try to interpret, then one loses the very core of the religious experience. This is my opinion. I mean, it's not in the sense of criticism, but it's more in the sense of debate, I would say. See, the uniqueness of the religious experience must be preserved and watched very carefully. Otherwise, there is no use of talking about religion. Logical, yes. But the logos itself is not somewhat, there is not a monistic logos, but apparently the logos itself can, so to say, disguise, the logos can disguise itself, so to say, in many garments, so to say. The logos is not a monolithic, so to say, being. If I may speak, I'm being. The intellect has a variety of approaches, because reality itself has many facets to reality. And each facet of reality, I mean, actually requires a specific approach. The pseudo scientific terminology used by the layman of today, I mean, this is one of the troubles of the layman, that uses a pseudo scientific terminology, not understanding what's behind it, is fascinating even for the student of religion, who only half-heartedly admits that the very outlook of religion and science is incongruous, because if it's incongruous with that if science and religion are not contradictory, they are incommensurate. So how can you apply scientific methods or forms or categories, I mean, in order to obtain religious knowledge? If we want to get a true picture of religious philosophy of man, we must practice caution in our usage of categories, terms and concepts, which are mostly products of our positivistic philosophical matrix, distinguishing themselves by their evenness and homogeneity. Basically, the scientific category is an even category. There is evenness in the category. There's a certain simplicity to the category. Of course, the mathematical equation is a very simple equation, and there is the quality of homogeneity to this scientific approach, while the religious approach is not even. It is a very paradoxical approach. It consists of contradictory motifs and elements which are mutually exclusive. This is the main difference. And of course, if the categories are, so to say, borrowed from the positivistic worldview, they cannot accommodate our unique religious experience, which is too paradoxical and too adventurous to fit into a general categorical mold. It is self-evident that the formation and formulation of a set of basic concepts of religious thinking, doing justice to the uniqueness and autonomy of a peculiar kind of knowing, is fraught with many difficulties, of course. And we must watch out not to become entangled in mystical daydreaming. It's exactly what you remarked. There is a danger. As soon as one departs, the positivistic scientific path is a straight one, because any departure can always be checked, and I have a criterion of, so to say, a criterion of distinction, and I can always identify whether I am the right path or I have departed or I deviated from this straight road. However, when you begin to develop categories of thinking for religious knowing, then there is the danger of being entangled in daydreaming, in mystical daydreaming. Actually, which defies the logos completely. And relating ourselves not to reality, but to some dream world. This exactly should be very careful. You should look out. Judaism, whatever you may say about Judaism, it was a very realistic religion. Very realistic. It never wanted to relate itself to a dream world, to some illusory reality. Because any illusion may become a delusion. The passage is a very easy one. Always wanted to cling to the here and now reality without taking any chances. And without engaging in the adventure of a reality which is not accessible to us. And that's, of course, it is a problem. It is a problem. The borderline between religious knowledge and mysticism is a very thin one. And many a time, one doesn't know whether he's still talking sense. Already, I mean, he's a citizen of a new realm, not of knowledge, but of experience. A new experiential realm, the realm of mysticism. And my job is not to develop mystical concepts. Perhaps they have their merit, they're important. Well, they are very modern now in the vogue because the new neo-Hasidic revival is based on mysticism. But to interpret Jewish experiences in logical terms. So you have to keep company with the logos and try not to depart from him. Because if we forsake the lovers, we may end up, I don't know where, in the same asylum. This is a general, but this problem, not a specifically today problem. It's a problem with which, I mean, the student of religion is concerned. I mean, religion itself can also be interpreted from many viewpoints. It can give an anthropological interpretation of religion. Then you're not looking for the unique features of religion, but on the contrary, you try to generalize religion. You see religion as an expression of the general cognitive, cultural consciousness, so to say. So then, of course, you apply scientific categories. You can give a psychology of religion. Of course, there is a psychology of religion. So this is not religious knowledge, but this is the knowledge. This is psychological interpretation of religion. This is scientific interpretation of religion. You can also give a history of religion. Of course, there is a history of religion. It means it's not trying to fight to discover in religion its uniqueness, but on the contrary, to classify religion under general categories. But we are not interested either in the psychology of religion, or history of religion, or anthropology of religion, or sociology of religion. I mean, these are strictly scientific disciplines. They're very important, but this is not our task. Our task is not a psychology of religion, but rather a religious psychology. Not what psychology thinks of religion, but what religion thinks of man. This is the difference. It's not a question of anthropology of religion, but a religious anthropology. What religion, I mean, what is the outlook of Judaism with regard to man and the world, particularly man, this strange being. So we cannot use scientific, so to say, premises or postulate system, but we have to mold, I mean, unique religious forms of thought in order to be able to interpret our religious experience in logical terms. This is number one. And this is exactly where we make the mistake between psychology of religion and religious psychology. Not to do. Psychology of religion is a scientific discipline. Religious psychology is something else. Now, we have a second problem to face. The second problem is not a universal problem at all. It's a specifically Judaic problem. While the first problem is not specifically Jewish, since it pertains to religious knowledge in general, and every homo religiosus anxious to interpret his experience in objective terms would face this dilemma, the second problem ties into a singular Jewish situation. It's a strange Jewish situation. It's due to our history, perhaps to our mentality. I don't know what it's due to, but it's strange. And we paid a high price for it, in terms of blood and suffering, whether in itself it is it's a positive feature or it's a negative feature in our mentality, I don't know. As Spinoza says, it's not trying to assess now Judaism, only to interpret. Not to laugh, not to cry, not to mourn, or to exalt, or to be elated, but simply to describe and to understand. It's not a question of forming value judgments about Judaism, but more to understand it. The Jewish homo religiosus is, or perhaps I may use the past tense, was a reticent person who, I'll say the present, is a reticent person who hides his inner strivings and soul movements behind a curtain of a disciplined obedience to the halacha and strict observance of the law. The God-man relationship was considered by the Jew as something too tender, too intimate, and too personal to be subjected to the process of objectification and confession. The Jew already thought that certain relationships belong into the sphere of private experiences, which a person of modesty would not desecrate by passing on information about them to strangers, to others. Of course, in an age where psychoanalysis is so popular, I mean, this sounds a bit queer, but this is a typically Jewish approach. The halacha disliked persons, disliked persons who share with their friends the secrets of their family life. The relationship, according to the halacha, between husband and wife, as we are accustomed to call it, between Adam and Eve, is too sacred an experience and must not be vulgarized and defiled by the intrusion of a third person into the private chambers of emotional life. Basically, I have no time here, but I could prove it with certain laws pertaining to that. The Song of Songs says, Eviani HaMelech Hadarav, Nagilav Nismach Habach, the king has brought me, it means the beloved one, into his inner chambers, we shall rejoice. And the emphasis is placed upon Hadarav, upon the inner chambers. There is something in man, or between the I and the thou, if I may use a term coined by Buber, between the I and the thou, which cannot be objectified, and somehow turned over or passed on to an outsider. And the same is true in the Jewish view of the God-man meeting, not only of Adam and Eve, but of God-man. It's very interesting that in Jewish mysticism, or even in our traditional midrashic literature, the God-man relationship was always identified with and compared to the love between husband and wife, or between man and woman. You know the traditional interpretation of the Song of Songs. According to the traditional interpretation of the Song of Songs, I mean, the whole story, the whole narrative, the whole drama does not represent carnal love, but the so-called relationship between God and man. So the God-man relationship is also a very intimate one. It takes place not on the outside, not in the world of color and sound, of motion, in the world of things and events, but in the inner depth of the human soul. Externalization and depersonalization, because any externalization of an experience But even when one is on the psychiatrist's couch and he externalizes an experience, it is ipso facto a depersonalization of the experience. The moment the experience leaves the inner recesses of the personality, it becomes an object. It isn't a subjective experience anymore. I face already my own experience. If it's known to me and I can formulate it, so it's not within me, but I face it, I encounter it. It's already a relationship between I and it, not between, it's a part of the I. Is any externalization or any depersonalization of this passionate, all-consuming love, I mean the love between man and God, in the form of a philosophical essay, or a narrative, or a biographical account, or exposition, is tantamount to an act of defilement. This was the Judaic approach. Jews were restrained throughout the ages from spelling out their inner experiences. I know I was brought up in a traditional Jewish home, a home of Talmudic scholars of note. And I was very devoted to my father. My father was very, very committed to me. As a matter of fact, I mean, I still suffer from a certain father complex. But he never told me one tender word. He never kissed me. Whenever we parted, for instance, and certain times when we parted, we simply didn't know whether or not we'll see each other again. He just shook my hand. He used to say, "Bon voyage," that's all. He simply could not spell out what he felt for me. Of course, I mean, when I used to see the gleam in his eye and the tremor in his hand, I could understand it, I could feel it, but never, it was never verbalized. And the Jews, and the same is true of my mother, and the same is true of my relationship to my children. Perhaps I'm a little becoming too personal. But it is, I mean, not that I'm sharing with you my individual experience, but it's a general characteristic of the Jew dating back to Moses. When Moses encountered God in the burning bush and he wanted to come a little closer, to search forward to this burning bush. So God summoned him and says, "Al tikrav halom, don't come too close." There is a certain distance separating man from God. Don't become the relationship should not be vulgarized. And Moses wanted to see God. So God told him, "Kelehirani odom v'choi, a human being cannot see me and survive." And also in the story of the burning bush, "Vayaster Moshe esponov," Moshe hid his face. "Ki yarem el ha'abit alakim," he was afraid to look at God.
There are certain experiences which should remain the inner recesses of the personality.
Any attempt at clarification, at analysis, at externalization, at objectification, is tantamount, in our view, to depersonalization. Of course, if it's depersonalized, it's also vulgarized. A sense of shyness held us back from engaging in self-expression and self-revelation. And it's very interesting that even the Jewish mystics, and the mystics in general, they are not shy people. Shyness was a quality alien to the mystic. When you read, for instance, the Confessions or the writings by Teresa or by Saint Bernard from Clairvaux, or even Saint Augustine, his Confessions, he's far from being shy. Many times he reminds me, when I'm reading Saint Augustine, he reminds me of Rousseau. Rousseau was a very arrogant fellow. He's speaking about himself. Not speaking about others, but about himself. And there is a certain frankness and there is a certain I don't know, a certain objectivity. And he was not restrained to tell us everything, with regard even to his father. Of course, I mean, there was the antagonism between him and his father, and his relationship, his peculiar relationship to the mother, St. Augustine. After he was a bishop and a famous Christian. In Jewish mystics, we have a rich literature of Jewish mysticism, but never a biographical literature. You'll never find any biographical notes. No. They always speak in general terms. Nothing revealing about the mystic himself, about his intercourse with divinity, about his private experiences, about the development, about the emergence of his worldview, how it happened. I mean, the background, you have nothing. Basically, if you study the Bible, you will find a very strange method in the Bible. When the Bible speaks about Moses, the accounts about Moses, the accounts about Abraham. So examining, I mean, the narrative in the Pentateuch, you'll find out that all you know about Moses is his life story over a period of 2 or 3 years. Nothing else. Of his youth, the Bible reports only 2 incidents. The incident of his birth, of course, and then his encounter with the Egyptian and with the Jew. I mean. And then he escaped to Midian. And when he came back to Egypt, he was, according to the account of the Bible, 80 years old. So when people close their autobiographies, so the Bible begins to tell us about Moses at the age of 83. And then all you have, in the entire account, biblical account, you have only, I mean, the events of 2 years. Because before he sent the scouts to Israel, it's 1 year. Then 38 years, they sojourned in the desert. There is no account of the 38 years. And then you have, I mean, the story of the last year of his life. Again, reticence, shyness. All the important highlights are disclosed. The rest is of no interest to us. Private life. Moses is only as important as his life ties in with the Jewish community. Moses as a private person is irrelevant to us. And the same is true of Abraham, the same is true of Isaac, the same is true of Jacob, the same is true of all biblical figures. Again, this type, this shyness. No biography, no biographical notes. Nothing. It's just an enigma. It's a void. Now, of course, gentlemen, if the passage from a subjective experience to an objective description, from our king's spiritual perceptions to well-organized philosophic comments, is a tortuous one. It is not easy to find the winding path leading from feeling to action, from inner movement to external attitudes, from the heart to the mind, from vision to thought, from emotion to concept, because the Jew always stopped in the middle. The emotion is not translated into a concept. Did he have a concept? He never tried to verbalize it. If he verbalized this concept, he never wrote it down, with the exception of Jewish law. If he wrote it down, he never published it. And so, I mean, we simply don't know much about Jewish philosophy. The beginning of Jewish philosophy we find in the Middle Ages, with Maimonides, Adya. And basically, it was an apologetic literature, not an original, unique Jewish philosophy. This perhaps has prevented, I said we paid a high price for this. This has prevented us, and I am convinced that it is true, from influencing the Gentile world prior to the beginning of the Common Era, when the idolatrous, polytheistic, mythological worldview was shattered, and the heathens who were ready to embrace a spiritualized form of religion and a new ethical code. So then there was a chance for Judaism to step forward and give to the Romans and the Greeks, the cultured peoples of that age, I mean, their interpretation of life. It would have been a success, I'm sure. But the Jew was too shy. He was too shy. He was afraid. He didn't spell out And of course, who stepped in? Christianity. And how did Christianity influence, so to say, accidental culture? Not by the Christian myth, because Christianity always, you have to look under a double aspect of Christianity. The aspect of the Christian myth, which is basically a mythological motif. The whole concept of Trinity, the birth and death, I mean, the idea of atonement by blood. And the second aspect under which we must see Christianity is the ethical one. And of course, there is no doubt, now theologians, I mean, neo-theologians will admit it readily, that the ethical, so to say, foundation of Christianity is Judaic, from A to Z. And with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, so you see how close, I mean, Christianity is to Judaism. And there was no need, basically, for scholars of Judaism to know the affinity between the Christian ethics and the Judaic ethics. I mean, basically, there is nothing new in Christian ethics. It's only a question of emphasis. Why didn't the Jewish community of the Second Commonwealth perform a similar job? Perhaps the whole course of Jewish history would have been changed, no doubt about it. And it could have avoided many, many problems, dilemmas, and troubles if it could have persuaded, I mean, the Roman Empire to embrace Judaism. Or at least the Roman aristocracy, the so-called Roman intellectuals, the decadent, sophisticated intellectuals who simply remind me always, need to remind me, modern man reminds me of the old Romans. Rather, I would say, modern man is reminiscent of the old Romans. It's very sophisticated, very abstract thinking, I mean, skeptical approach to the world, but still a yearning for ultimates. Not having ultimates, but still yearning for ultimates. Not believing in any absolute values, but still searching for them. This was a terrific chance for Judaism. Judaism missed the boat. Already the Khuzari, Yehuda Alevi, in the Middle Ages, asked this question. Or he gives an apologetic answer. Because if Judaism had become the religion of the majority, it would have been vulgarized and our pages would have been stained with blood as the pages of the Christian church. Perhaps it is true, perhaps it's untrue, I don't know. But it's not a question of justifying or indicting or defending, I mean, the Jews of the Second Commonwealth. They simply couldn't do that. They couldn't. My father couldn't confess his love for me. They couldn't simply confess their love for God. Of course, they wanted to pass on to the Romans a strict system of halakha, of laws. The Romans were not ready to accept it. And our reticence also, and our shyness, and our silence about matters, about subjective experience, is also responsible to a great extent for the malicious accusation on the part of our foes and friends, perhaps alike. I don't say that everybody who tries to indict us for certain faults of ours or failures or deficiencies is an enemy, perhaps is a friend as well. The accusation about rabbinic legalism, of the fossilization of the religious experience in a mess of technical details, of losing sight of God because of the too many laws. It's not true, gentlemen. I'm not apologetic here. But the outsider, I don't blame the outsider if such a charge is made by him. Because we were reticent. We didn't tell him about it. How can he know if we didn't confide in him? The truth is that the Jewish homo religiosus is only ashamed to betray his inner secrets to others. The ecstatic experience of encountering God is too precious a possession to which the lovesick soul clings and which it refuses to share with others. That's all. Perhaps it's egotistic, egocentric. But there is no lack of the subjective, passionate experience as far as Jewish religion is concerned. And behind the abstract halacha, the formal legalistic principles, the homo religiosus, the Jewish homo religiosus, beholds a wonderful vision of infinity. Somehow he never told about it to anybody. And this makes our task more difficult. Because you don't have a continuous tradition of interpretation. For instance, imagine that if there would be not Platonic school of interpretation,
There would be no Platonic tradition in the Occidental culture.
We wouldn't be able to interpret Plato, because he's so far from us. He's so distant. I don't mean distant in years, in terms of chronology, but distant in concepts, in ideas, in categorical approach to reality. But what makes, the interpretation of Plato possible for us is this tradition. We, unfortunately, have a very, very loose tradition of religious philosophy. That's what makes our task, if we are about to interpret Jewish philosophy in modern terms, more difficult and very complicated. And that's why many books on Jewish philosophy are either what I say it is just an act of proselytization of Christian concepts. All right, taking Christian concepts on it and introducing them into a Judaic system, or it's modernization, just apologetics, or it's complete distortion of the very core of the Jewish religious experience. It's not the fault of the interpreters, it's perhaps the fault of our history, or perhaps of our peculiar mentality. Now,
I'm just wondering,
yes?
Was there a divine stimulation for this reticence, shyness, that is inherent within the Jewish man? Or is this a kind of thing that he just took out of air, or just grew with? Or is there a divine quality to it?
See, the quality of what you call in Hebrew tzniut, modesty. The quality of modesty, tzniut, is basic in the Jewish code of ethics. But tzniut not only with regard to my carnal, so to say, behavior, to my physiological drives, impulses, but also to my spirit, with regard to the spelling out of my emotional experiences. Whether it's a good quality or a bad quality, I'm not ready to judge. I don't know. But it is modesty. The Jew is a modest person. It's hard to say sometimes of modern Jew, but traditional Jew is true. He was a modest person. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You said the homo religiosus was, and then you said.
I'll tell you, friends, I don't know where the modern Jew can be found, so that's why I mixed up about the tenses. Sometimes I use present tense, and another time I use past tense. But I don't know where to place the modern Jew. I don't know.
Your relation with your son, your relation with your father.
Yes.
I will also externalize an experience.
Yes.
Up to a certain age, I held to that behavior with reference to my son.
Yes.
Until he was about 12. And not so much because of the cognition of the what it is in me that did that. That's the way we were brought up. As Jews, we didn't observe birthdays,
yes.
We observe anniversaries, and so on.
Yes.
That's the way I was brought up, and that's the way I behaved toward my son. I gave myself a very severe thinking through, and decided that I would have to change,
yes.
And change,
yes.
And change radically the other way.
Yes.
To that point that I thought that the was and is very significant. In today's world, shall we not rethink this tradition? Shall we? Shall you not rethink that?
I have a lot of my
troubles.
Not what? I have a lot of my problems to counter. I paid already. But I say, Dr. Eisenberg, the fact that we are here, it means that we are breaking with this tradition, otherwise I wouldn't be here. Not with regard to my son, but with regard to the more intimate relationship, God-man. Rendezvous, Perhaps, I didn't say it is very important. I said before, it's not a value judgment, just a statement of facts. I don't say perhaps. We'll come to this problem later, and we'll try to understand it.
That's troubling, but I'm just wondering whether, in the light of today,
yeah.
Whether we ought not to reconstruct.
Perhaps we have to change many things in Judaism. I don't know. I'm not suggesting any practical, methods, of approach, but just trying to state facts, yes.
I'm trying to relate this to our whole concept of our helping profession in the social welfare field as Jews, where the basic concept of tzedakah and the recognition of the need to help someone else.
Yes, sir.
And our function very often brings us into the realm of sharing. The person who comes for help sharing with us some of the experiences.
Yes.
And I'm trying to relate this to
Yes, of course, in tzedakah, you know, I mean, when I have to tell you, in tzedakah, anonymity is very important about the Jewish law, anonymity in tzedakah. And of course, I mean, and, but however, I mean, many times, not only psychiatrists, the rabbi as a rabbi, you know, and the fact that the man can come to me, simply cry on my shoulder, that's all, I mean, I'm just as clever as he is, I mean, I haven't more wisdom than the person, than the congregant who comes to me for advice. But the fact that he can lean on my shoulder and cry and share what troubles him is already a help. It's already, I mean, and we know about it in Jewish law, the expression Da'aga b'levis li'sechenu, if a man is worried, let him tell it to others. I mean, is known to us. So it means, what I said, it's not always, it shouldn't be taken at its face value, I mean, as a central principle. It's more a feature of our mentality. And many times, we have to break with this tradition, I mean, in order to help others, no doubt about it. Otherwise, I mean, on the contrary, I'll come to it later. There is also, I mean, another aspect, of course, a contradictory aspect of sharing joy with others, or sharing sadness and war and trouble with others. But we'll come to it. But you are right, I mean, this social service is based not on being secretive and being shy and reticent, because there should be some relatedness, the person who asks for help and the social, I'm perhaps venturing into a field which is, it's arrogant on my part, but as I understand social work, there's a mutual relatedness. I mean, the social worker has to relate himself to the person who applies for help, and the person who applies for help must have confidence, confined. So of course, I mean, introducing this method of keeping my secrets, my experiences for myself, and of being bottled up and not externalize what I feel, would create dilemmas and problems, I mean, for any kind of social service or reward, no doubt about it. But what I wanted to say is that philosophy of religion, that's why philosophy of religion did not occupy a central place in Judaism, because it simply did not spell out what we felt. I mean, that's all that I wanted to say. Will you allow me to go on for a while? Now, all right, we'll have to develop a religious anthropology. This religious anthropology, contrary to scientific anthropology, already, I mean, here we see already the distinction, contrary to scientific anthropology, will be based upon a priori premises and operates in a fashion similar to that of pure mathematics and physics with a postulate system. Of course, it's not, the religious anthropology is not an experimental anthropology. It operates with a postulate system, which came down to us from the very dawn of the charismatic community, and which is rooted in the deepest strata of the paradoxical God-man fellowship awareness. It's a postulate system, as for instance in geometry, the parallel system. You can't prove it, but you operate with it. Our method of research would be not inductive, but deductive. Because if there is a postulate system, you know very well, any science with a postulate system is a deductive science, like mathematics or physics, is a deductive science. We presuppose certain axiomatic verities about the nature of man, his enigmatic existence, his unique faith, and destiny, and from this a priori position, we try to gain a full view of this singular being. Of course, these speculative ideas, which are inherent in our religious ontic and meta-ontic experience, have been checked in Judaism and rechecked against historical events and experiences of empirical man. We have always practiced Kantian prudence and restraint. The a priori has served us only as the clue to the factual and the real. Its relevance has been measured by its applicability within the framework of facticity. We've never said, like the certain Catholic dogmas, this is our premise and that's all, take it or leave it. Whether reality, contradicts this premise, so we don't care about reality. The Jew was too much of a realist. He had a priori premises, not dogmas. Dogma is a word which is absolutely alien to the Jewish cause, the Jewish religion. A priori premises, a partial system, like matter is a partial system, and geometry is the basis of the Euclidean geometry. And even the non-Euclidean geometry has a partial system, like physics has a partial system. So, but we always, but the physicists will keep on checking and rechecking. For instance, Euclidean geometry is based upon the postulate system of a three-dimensional space, with the emergence of the non-Euclidean geometry, Lobachevsky, Riemann, even before when Helmholtz physiologically began to prove the existence, the possibility of a multi-dimensional space. So the mathematician had to recheck his postulate system. And you know how physics works now, in the at the microcosmic level, it operates with the macrocosmic level, it operates with the non-Euclidean geometry. So it's checked and rechecked. And the idea of body and energy also belong in the postulate system. But with the equation of Einstein, this postulate system has been checked and changed. Judaism has also a postulate system because it's impossible. Religion cannot be based on experience only, for a simple reason. Because we will never find God in experience only. Some people believe in religio naturalis, so-called natural religion. Perhaps there is a yearning for God, yes, there is a yearning for God. There is a religious impulse which drives man to relate himself to ultimates, to something, to the what the Neoplatonic philosopher used to call the epikeia, to the beyond, somehow to find anchorage, to strike roots in reality, yes. But what you would have never found, in experience itself, in our daily routine, we would have never found this ultimate, it's a postulate system. Yes, we have never engaged in limitless speculation and postulation, transcending the empirical, and we have never been reluctant to rectify some of our a priori views if we realize that they run contrary to basic religious and historic realities. Yet, all this has been done with an axiomatic frame of reference. May I add that within this postulate system, I called your attention to it last time, we have always had at our disposal several axiomatic patterns, sometimes mutually exclusive, thus enabling us to cope with changing situations and perplexing occurrences in a manner reminiscent of the modern mathematician and physicist, who are not confined to one set of postulates, who are able to interpret a multifaceted reality by taking advantage of a variety of a priori symbols. The so-called Aristotelian principle of contradiction is not valid anymore in modern physics and mathematics. Judaism has never recognized this Aristotelian principle. As I said last time, two contradictions, both are true. How is it possible? I don't know. It's paradoxical, absurd, but this is a part of Judaism. So later, when I'll speak about man, you may wonder whether I'm in the right mind, you see. But this will be the method. However, so first we have to develop a metaphysic of man, not a psychology, a functional psychology of man. Because if we work with a postulate system, you cannot start with a functional psychology. But you have to start with a metaphysic philosophy of man. The term is irrelevant. On the other hand, the metaphysic of man could not remain just another formal doctrine, describable only in terms of discursive thinking. It had to become something more than that. The doctrine had to be transposed into a living creed, to which we are unreservedly committed and which reveals itself through our total behavior. And let's not forget the following truisms. The halacha, as a practical regulative discipline, has never subscribed to philosophical abstracts, save in so far as they precede action. If I need the philosophical abstract...
about it abstract. Otherwise, a concept doesn't mean anything. The Jew always emphasized action. In its insistence, in the halacha's insistence upon the deed, and its attempt to guide men in both the subjective and objective existential areas, the halacha is being concentrated upon functional themes within our metaphysics. Not so much about speculation, but metaphysics is important. But insofar as metaphysics can be translated into a functional theme, into a functional motif. Religious awareness of virtue, which is based upon metaphysical insights, is important. The noesis, the Greek concept of speculation, can be transposed into a dynamic force. Then a transcendental experience can be, so to say, objectified into a factum. It is self-evident that the metaphysic of man could not be an exception to this general rule, and Judaism, therefore, was impelled to undertake the transformation of a metaphysic into an actuality, into a functional psychology, drawing upon the most hidden recesses of our religious metaphysical experience, which is essentially rooted in a self-transcending consciousness, reaching outside of the here and now reality, like any other religion, into the eternal and infinite. Judaism has translated these unique experiences into empirical categories and patterns of human behavior, in which we are interested particularly. Thus, the metaphysic of man emerged as a powerful motive in our actual, and the emphasis on actual, in our actual self-awareness, capable of shaping and determining our destiny and of leaving its imprint upon our personality as the latter develops by the patient efforts of a lifetime. It means, of course, we start with the metaphysic of man, but Judaism has never stopped at the metaphysic, like Neoplatonic philosophy, or even Christianity many times. It always tried to find in metaphysical ideas practical motifs and translate them into functional terms. Basically, it is very strange here in America, perhaps not with regard to Judaism, it's with regard to science in general. When they speak about basic research, when I begin to read the papers and they say, I mean, you need basic research in order to advance the frontiers of human knowledge, particularly of knowledge of nature. So they have a funny concept of basic research. When they speak of basic research, they mean also laboratory research, research determined by the trial and error method. I mean, these are, I speak about papers, I mean, journalists, correspondents. But this is a mistaken notion. Basic research means metaphysical intuition. As a matter of fact, this miraculous transition from metaphysical world formulae to empirical knowledge is not unknown in the history of human thought. The mathematico-scientific interpretation of the universe is also based on such a leap from the a priori to the functional, from the philosophical-metaphysical to the mathematical-theoretical and technological. In fact, it has even begun to dawn upon us, who are steeped in positivistic and pragmatic prejudices, that the scientific explanation of the cosmic process, contrary to the opinion of the uninitiated layman, who considers it to be a result of trial and error research program, is an expression of a metaphysical approach to reality. And the fundamental method is deductive, the primary procedure, a performance of spontaneity, of creativity of man. The very idea constituting the basis of our scientific inquiry, to me this is the most important idea in science, introduced by Newton and Galileo, of the possibility of mathematization and quantification of our qualitative sense experience data. Without this idea, there would be no physics and no chemistry if we cannot quantify and mathematize our sense experiences. This very idea is not an experimental, so to say, advance, but a metaphysical achievement based on spontaneous creative postulation rather than on piecemeal fact-finding exploration. Of course, the experiment confirms or refutes the cogency of the postulated premise, correct, determines the detail
the exact formulation and the practical application. However, the general outline, the basic patterns and principles of our scientific philosophy, which were developed by the fathers of our classical and modern physics, are of an a priori metaphysical strain and were born not in the laboratory, but in the mind. And this is, in my opinion, this is one of the basic drawbacks in American research, that everything must be born in the laboratory. Of course, it can be born in the laboratory, even you, one will find, I hope, medical therapy for cancer and all, I mean, degenerative diseases, yes. But when you have to push forward the frontiers of knowledge, like the Einstein's theory of relativity, Planck's theory of quantum mechanics, Schrödinger's theory of wave mechanics, this is not born in the laboratory. The laboratory confirms, refutes, but this is basically an intuition. The intuition of men who, like God, is also a creator. And in order to have this intuition, a climate must be developed stimulating this type of work. When we the need for a new interpretative approach to reality for the extension of our scientific frontiers becomes acute, laboratory techniques are of no avail, and only the metaphysical genius may intuit and behold new horizons and verities, and translate these a priori ideas into natural laws and mathematical patterns. I remember during my student days in Berlin, I was very friendly with Dr. Jakob Grommer. He was actually an associate of Einstein. Basically, the mathematical work was done by Grommer. Contrary to popular notion that Einstein was the greatest mathematician, Einstein was not one of the greatest mathematicians. So the technical work, mathematical work, the formulation of his ideas and mathematical equations, it was done by Grommer. Grommer was one of the leading mathematicians. Then later he was called to the University of Moscow, and actually, I mean, he is the one who developed, actually, who is responsible for the great advances which Russia has made in the field of science. He was a genius mathematician. I know him because he was a Russian boy who came to Göttingen, Germany, studied, and became famous. But of course, on account of German anti-Semitism, he was not appointed professor of mathematics at German University, had to leave, and became the head of the mathematical school of mathematics in Moscow University. So once I asked him, and actually you'll find, for instance, on this Einstein's favorite theme, the unified field, the gravitational, the electromagnetic field, you'll find all essays by Einstein, all pamphlets by Einstein and Jakob Grommer. So I asked him once, what is Einstein's actually, how does he see Einstein? And what is his forte, so to say, his greatness? So I asked him, is mathematics? No. And he mentioned to me, enumerated a few names of German mathematicians who are by far superior to him. So what is it? It's just, he told me that he used the word, of course, the German word, Schauen, which means intuit, to behold. He beholds something. When he sees something, he's not sure whether it is an illusion or perhaps it's a dream, daydreaming, or scientific idea. But then he begins whatever he felt. Einstein told him that suddenly he ponders over a problem, ponders and tries to analyze the problem. And still he doesn't see light. And suddenly, it's like a flash goes on, a light goes on, and everything becomes clear. And new horizons beckon to him. And then, I mean, whatever he sees in this moment, he tries to develop it. This is creativity, basically. This is the creativity of the artist. This is the creativity of the poet. It is also the creativity of the scientist. This is the great. This was the creativity on the part of Newton. The legends tells us about the apple, how he discovered the law of gravitation. What does it mean? A small incident, whatever the legend is true or untrue, is irrelevant. But what does it mean? It was not laboratory technique. He was pondering over the problem. His mind was arrested, I mean, by this problem. He had no peace of mind. I mean, he wanted to understand why a body should fall downward. And suddenly, a small incident like the falling of an apple from a tree on a summer evening suddenly uncovered new resources in him, new creative resources. And he formulated at that time the law of gravitation, mm over d squared. Since this is exactly what is necessary in order... Germany made tremendous advances in theoretical physics because they had this... I don't know, because they had a certain inclination for metaphysical thinking. Positivistic philosophy is very nice and good if you want to simplify matters. It's very nice. But when a man becomes creative, not only as an artist, but as a scientist in all fields, he should not look at the world under the aspect of simplicity, but on the contrary, under the aspect of paradoxality, and sometimes absurdity. And this encounter with opposition, this encounter with the mysterium magnum, with this alien, strange world, which scoffs at him and sometimes behaves in an unfriendly manner toward him, if he has this passionate approach, he may simply conquer the land. And this is exactly metaphysics. There can be no science without total involvement. There can be anything in this world without total involvement. And basically, when I classify, for instance, philosophical schools, and I take the metaphysical school in comparison with the positivistic school, or pragmatic school, of Peirce, James, Whitehead, Dewey, I mean, all these, so I always have another illustration. It's the difference between Hasidim and Misnagdim. You see, calmness, very common sense, I mean, everything is figured out, mathematically correct, and there is ecstasy. This is on the part of Misnagdim, to which I belong to them. On the other hand, there is a Hasidic group, ecstatics, always, I mean, the religious experience is passionate, they are many times they're not coherent, very paradoxical, but they are more creative. And if it is true of science, it's certainly true, gentlemen, of religion. Certainly true of religion. If there is no total involvement, there is no unreserved surrender, if there is no all-consuming commitment, there is no religion, gentlemen. At the practical level, so we start with a metaphysic, and we finally develop out of the metaphysic a functional psychology. The purpose of religion and science is the same. Practical results, yes. But the question is, how do you get there? Can you have a shortcut? So the old saying by Euclid, there is no royal road to geometry. And there is no royal road to religion in general, and particularly to Judaic experience. At the practical level, now I'm coming to another aspect. At the practical level, how did the metaphysic of man translate itself into functional terms? This is the problem. What is the passage? We know in science what is the passage is the mathematical equation. There is a theory, basically a theoretical theory. For instance, that energy and matter are identical. You know how far it goes back to the old Greeks. Einstein didn't discover anything in that by his famous equation. But what did Einstein find? The passage from a metaphysical illusion expressed by Heraclitus and Pythagoras, I mean by all of them, and Aristotle, that there is unity in nature, there's identity in nature. If there's identity in nature, you can look at nature under two aspects, under the aspect of energy and under the aspect of matter. It's one. Spinoza knew of it, I mean, later in the 17th century. But what did Einstein accomplish? He found the passage from a metaphysical thought, which is nothing more than an illusion, to a scientific fact by mathematizing the thought, by finding the mathematical equation. So what is the equation? We can't speak of mathematical equations. What is the passage leading from metaphysic of man to a psychology of man in religious terms? What is? Is at the practical level, the metaphysic of man has found its finest expression in Judaism, in its application to and interpretation and elucidation of our emotional life. In my opinion, when we want to see how the metaphysic of man, which is a postulate, based on a postulate system, and operates with abstract concepts, which one can dismiss as some figments of thought, or some imaginary visions. I mean, this passage from theory to practice, from vision to reality, is via the emotional medium, via the emotional experience of man. And Judaism has developed a funny theory. Of course, I'll show you that this was known later, was proclaimed later by a Christian philosopher. But again, our misfortune, Judaism knew about it in antiquity. It's known in history of philosophy, it's known as the theory of a certain Christian philosopher. But however, Judaism has an elaborate system of that. Judaism has attributed, and I would beg you to pay attention now to what I'm going through, because this is the basis will be of our entire class. Judaism has attributed metaphysical and logical relevance to our feelings and has endowed them with an intrinsic truth motif. The affective sphere within man, Judaism says. The affective sphere, I mean the emotional sphere within man, I'll use the philosophical term for that. Within man, not natural man, in his full immediacy. The man who rises above his immediate, instinctive, compulsive life functions. Because the savage, the jungleman, the caveman did not rise about his compulsive life functions. Insofar as his emotional reactions are concerned. And man who tries to gain some sort of independence, capacity for meditation, reflective self-viewing and self-reckoning of this type of man, who is able to meditate, to reflect, to view himself, who can face himself, is the feelings of this type of this man is determined by rational insights into himself and into the world into which he was thrown in. The emotional act, Judaism said, is related to a cognitive experience. It is based upon a cognitive experience and is not to be separated from man's metaphysical convictions. There is conviction in feelings. We always think there is conviction in thought. There's no conviction in feelings. When you say a man, a very emotional man, always says very emotional. So in the colloquial it means, I mean, you can't count on him, he changes like the weather. Fair weather friend, that's all, nothing else. There's no convictions. This is not true, according to Judaism. Emotions have convictions, are endowed with convictions. Judaism treats the sentiments neither as modi cogitandi, in a manner similar to that of the medieval scholars. They also thought it's modi cogitandi, it's modes of thinking. But then it was of confused thinking. Inferior to the clear cogitatio, for instance in Descartes, of the intellect, nor Judaism treats the feelings not as being guided solely by pragmatic considerations or instinctive motives, as many classical psychologists maintain. Any classical psychologist will tell you that of course feelings are guided by certain motives, like the survival, self-preservation. Of course, the yearning, I mean, man's drive for pleasure, for self-destruction, I mean, you can have all kinds of theories. But these are not metaphysical ideas. These are instincts, perhaps sometimes sublimated instincts, which are reflected in feelings. Now, Judaism agrees with that. But this is not what Judaism, I mean, wanted to say. But Judaism considers the emotional life as an autonomous, singular medium through which the logos addresses itself to man, and the emotional life is equipped with its own unique categorical mode, shaping ideas into feelings and notions into emotional attitudes. As modi cogitandi, this was known to Thomas Aquinas, Albertus Magnus, to Descartes, Spinoza, but they dismissed it as confused ideas. As an expression of our basic instinctive drives, natural drives, was known to classical psychology since Kant, since the 18th century. It is still actually, I mean, the basic, even in psychoanalysis, it's the basic theory. But Judaism speaks about metaphysical ideas, not so much relatedness of man to himself, which could come under the heading of instinctive drives, but relatedness of man to the beyond. They come to expression in our affective life. Thus, the metaphysic of man speaks to us with the voice and language not only of the depersonalized intellect, but of a warm and sensitive heart. This approach does not contradict modern psychiatric and psychological methods which try to explain the emotional life by tracing it to the most basic impulses and physical psychical dynamics. Doesn't contradict. Judaism, not engaging in any argument with the empiricists, only adds another dimension to the human affective sphere and sees in it noetic, and I'm using the word noesis as the Greeks understood, as metaphysical, noetic patterns and logical structures which reflect the metaphysical transcendental aspects of the human experience. My metaphysical experience is not only expressed through words, of course, logos logoi, in Greek it was the same thinking and speaking, logos logoi, but it expresses itself through my heart, my feelings. If I love somebody, if I love, there is some metaphysical idea to it. If I hate, there is some noetic pattern to it. If I resent something, there is some logical structural patterns in this hatred. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong. I mean, science may make mistakes. So certainly our emotions are also entitled to some margin of error. You understand me? But there is. Of course, the Jewish, if I may use the term now, the Jewish logique de coeur, if I may use a Pascalian term, in history philosophy, Pascal said that the heart is committed to metaphysical ideas. And the famous expression logique de coeur, the Jewish logique de coeur, is inferred not only from our anthropological experience. As far as this is concerned, some empiricists would agree with us, is inferred not only from our anthropological experience, manifesting the will to survive at the minimum of discomfort and pain, but also from a meta-ontic and transcendental source. That is, thus, the heart, dominated by logical reasons, is not only practical, because according to the empiricist, classical psychology, the heart is practical. Feelings are practical. When I have fear, what am I afraid of? When there is a menace to my existence. It's the instinct of survival tells me to be afraid. When I enjoy something, when I rejoice, so as classical psychologists will tell you, you rejoice because you probably derive some pleasure. Or you feel that your survival is more secure. When you are sad, something happened to which undermines. It's just practical. The heart, according to classical psychology, is a businessman, so to say. It's very pragmatic, only engaged in business. It's a commercial heart, of course, not a question of selling merchandise, stockings on our heads, but selling man himself, I mean, his existence. That's all. According to Judaism, it is true, the heart is practical. But the heart is also a sentimentalist, I would say. The heart is not only practical, self-centered, cautious, this according to psychology, cautious and scheming, but also heroic, sacrificing, and visionary, exhibiting the deep-seated yearning in man for something great, redeeming, elevating, and meaningful. The heart is not only interested in self-survival at the minimum of discomfort, but interested in living a great life. I always say Judaism has never been interested in peace of mind. When Dr. Liebman published his book, so I told him, the book is very nice, but this is not the ideal of Judaism. Perhaps it's rooted in Christianity, yes. And that's why for Christians, the chapter in the Psalm, Ad Hashem Roi Le'echser, God is my shepherd, I shall not want, became one of the most popular hymns. Why? Because there, in this psalm, the idea of religion, of fellowship between men and God, expressed in practical terms, because of peace of mind, exactly. I don't believe Judaism will speak about it. I don't believe Judaism is so much interested in peace of mind. Judaism, I believe, instead of trying to make men lead a happy life, is attempting very hard to make men lead a great life. and a happy life and a great life are not always commensurate, and I don't believe there is a mathematical equation between happiness and greatness. Through the heart, the great message of existence, of an existence which neither begins nor ends within the actual finite cycle, but reaches outside fact and incident into a realm where both the arche, the origin, and the telos, destiny, are to be found. This message basically is delivered not to the logos, but not to the intellect, but to the heart. Feelings are provided with noetic motifs, which point at the roots of existential actuality and facticity, and manifest the most unique experience, namely that of self-transcending. Emotional orderliness, consistency, sincerity, and even depth are possible not only within the true, not only within thoughts, but also within feelings. We say a thought is shallow, we say a thought is deep, profound. We say thoughts are coherent if they fit into a unified system. They are incoherent if they cannot be combined, be unified. What's about feelings? Judaism believes if there are deep, profound feelings, we say profound love, and also shallow feelings. There are coherent feelings which combine in a system of feelings. And there are incoherent feelings, isolated moods, transient moods. There are true feelings and there are false feelings. What means a true feeling? If I love, how can it be true? How can it be false? It means in relationship to the idea it represents. If the feeling represents the wrong idea, it's a false feeling. If it represents a true idea, it's a true feeling. Judaism, I want to add something else. Judaism has also held the view that there is not only reasons of the heart, a logique de coeur, but also norms of the heart, laws pertaining to the heart. We are used to the idea that laws of conduct, pertain only to our physical acts, to our hands, legs, to our speaking, but not to the heart. Feelings should not be regulated by norms. I can't help feeling. Again, if we were to use a Pascalian term, we would say that the logique de coeur is complemented by an ordre de coeur. There is order within the heart. The connative element in our feelings, which drives us to action, is interpreted by Judaism in terms of axiological reference, of moral strivings, of value judgments, and value patterns. Not only metaphysical ideas reveal themselves to us via our heart, our emotional sphere, but also values are disclosed to us. We intuit values, ideals. There is a scale of values which reveals itself to man via the medium of his emotional life. The human craving for self-realization and self-redemption finds its richest expression not in the abstract intellect or the aggressive will, but in the tender and yet profound heart feeling. We may speak of an ethic of the heart, as we speak of an ethic of our actions. Morality of the heart, as we speak of morality of our deeds. Which is, of course, based upon the logic of the emotional activity of man. The ethic borrows ideas from the logic and converts them into ideals. The logic of the heart says every feeling is related to an idea. The ethic says not only to an idea. An idea is not as important as an ideal. It's related to an idea, so to say, in retrospect, but it's also committed to an ideal. There is a metaphysical idea which expresses itself in the emotional experience. The emotional experience is committed to the achievement of a great ideal. It is a truism that in Judaic philosophy that the emotional life is not a neutral area, where the norm is inoperative. The Torah has formulated laws, even the Pentateuch, governing not only the external behavior, but also the inward activity of man. There are norms pertaining to love. You shall love your neighbor as thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. How can one be commanded to love if there is no ethic of the heart? I can tell him, give charity, yes, because I can stretch, can put my hand into my pocket and give him a coin. But how can the Torah command us, to love our neighbor? Or love thy God, the Lord thy God, with your heart, mind, and soul. L'sisno esachicha belovecho, you must not hate thy brother. If I want to hate him, he did harm to me. Problems which were raised by the medieval scholars. So there was one scholar, Ibn Ezra, great scholar, a bit of a cynic. He himself had a rough deal in life. Was a pauper, had to always to ask, to beg for support, and no one gave him support. That time there was no social service. So he asked, "What do you mean, leisach meit beisachicha? Do not covet what your friend possesses. If I'm envious, what can I do?" So he said, in a very vulgar way, but it contains the kernel of truth, "I've never seen the boy of an illiterate peasant falling in love with the princess." Why? The princess is beautiful. Why shouldn't the boy of the peasant or the slave fall in love with the princess? So the answer is very simple. Apparently the heart is sometimes not overwhelmed by the emotion, but has reasons. If something is impractical and impossible to attain, the heart, so to say, retreats. There is a retreat on the part of the emotion. When this emotion is so absurd that it could never be realized, translated into action, into fact. So if this is the case, the Ibn Ezra says, so all questions are solved. What does it mean? There is a logic decur and there is an ethic decur. You can, as Adler says, there is of course a possibility to assimilate emotions into my, let's say, whole, into the whole of my consciousness, my personality. There is also a possibility of holding emotions at bay, of holding emotions at a distance, unless one is an eccentric. But a normal person can actually judge emotions, either disown them or assimilate them. And this is exactly what Judaism has been preaching for many centuries and millennia. They are morally worthy and morally unworthy feelings. And one is duty-bound to form the right emotional attitude. Out of the metaphysic of man, a logic and an ethic of his emotional life, which is subject to intellectual interpretation, axiological normative variation, emerged. And it would be up to us to examine both the logical and ethical vistas of our inward emotional life. Around this, our series, our lectures will revolve. All right. I'm through the portion for today.
The logic and ethic of the heart, that you speak of, yes, is remarkably similar to the work that is going on now with anthropology on culture value orientation. Yes. Would you say that these are the...
Yeah, but there is more pragmatic. It's just a pragmatic approach there. Our approach, of course, it results in practical conclusions, yeah. But it's basically a metaphysical approach. Yeah. Yes, but it's known, but you see, the idea known depends how you utilize it, what you try to infer from that. I mean, the main discrepancy will emerge when we'll see what Judaism is doing with it, and what moderns, for instance, metaphysicians, psychologists,
the attempt of Professor Heschel to force language.
I beg your pardon?
The attempt of Professor Heschel,
yes,
to force language to portray these paradoxes, these absurdities, making for an impossibility of understanding
Yeah.
It's that basic to that leap, to that approach.
I did not grasp the question.
The Heschel style.
Yeah.
And the Heschel vocabulary.
Yeah, speak about the style, about the philosophy.
I'm talking a moment about the style.
Yeah.
It tries to kind of objectify.
Yeah.
A paradigm, an absurdity.
Yeah. Yes.
A mode of expression which a homo theoreticus can't follow.
Yeah.
Is that necessary to a...
You're asking me?
I'm asking you.
I'm not supposed to give the answer to that. However, I mean, I believe that that the interpretation of the religious experience should be comprehensible and understandable to everybody. If not, it's not interpretation. It's mysticism, if this is the case. I'm not so acquainted with his philosophy, I must say, but if this is the case, it's mysticism. If to objectify a phenomenon means to make it available and accessible to everybody. Otherwise, it's not an objectified concept.
In other words, the style should be the style of...
For instance, I have recommended in the reading, a book by Kierkegaard, Repetition, to be very important with regard to the problem of evil. Kierkegaard had a habit of making it as difficult as possible for the reader to understand it. All right, so you say he was a neurotic. That's what you said. And certainly, Kierkegaard did not want the reader should do him a favor. He didn't beg. You see, a modern author always wants to please the reader. The reader should do him a favor and buy his book. I don't mean buy in a sense, because he'll pay that in a few dollars. But he wants to be read by people. In order to be read by people, he'll try to make the book as plausible and as appealing to the average man as possible. Kierkegaard had just employed the method in the reverse, to make it as difficult as possible and to limit the circle of readers. If this is the intention of Dr. Heschel as well, I don't know. But I don't know. It's hard for me to say. But basically, I like to explain concepts in a language which is comprehensible to everybody. It doesn't mean comprehensible to the man from the street, but to intellectual or man of culture should understand. Whether he'll agree or disagree is a different problem, but should be comprehensible. Did you add what I asked you? Did you add? I would also ask you to add to this, what is the list, the reading list?
Yeah.
To where there is Maimonides, the guide, it is section 1, chapter 2, yes, correct?
Yeah, chapter
should be,
1.
It should be section 1, chapter 1 and 2. Chapter 1 and 2.
Okay.
1 and 2. Then add something. At least the book of Koheleth, of the Ecclesiastes. It's a short book, you can get acquainted with it. Yeah. And then, the Book of Job. The Book of Job is a big book. As much as possible, particularly the 5-6 chapters at the beginning and the last five or six chapters of the book. Because the problem of evil is bound up with the Book of Job, and the problem of frustration it was treated by Koheleth, by the Ecclesiastes.
All right.
The next meeting is December 4. You'll get a notice of the other people. There's coffee here.
I got to run to get my car.
This is the end of lecture 2. Just a little bit more tape to go, and that's the end of this tape. Lecture 3 will be on the next tape. Goodbye.